The St. Petersburg Museum of History hosted another in their series of very popular Happy Hours with the Historian last Thursday evening at the museum. The special guest speaker last week was Francis Gary Powers Jr., son of the famed U-2 pilot shot down by the Soviet Union in the Cold War. Mr. Powers was introduced by the executive director of the museum, Rui Farias.
For 20 years, I taught high school students about the Cold War, right? Florida's involvement, and of course, this famous U-2 flight over the Soviet Union. I never thought I'd be able to experience this thing in person. Tonight's speaker lectures internationally, appears regularly on C-SPAN, the History Channel, Discovery, and A&E. He's an author. He's got 4 books right up there that he'll be happy to sell and sign for you after the event. He's the founder of the Cold War Museum outside of Washington, D.C., and a former board member of the Strategic Air Command and Aerospace, as well as the International Spy Museum. In 2015, he consulted for Steven Spielberg's Cold War thriller, Bridge of Spies. And oh yes, he happens to be the son of Francis Gary Powers Sr., the pilot of that famous U-2 fighter. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Powers Jr.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome. It's great to be back in St. Petersburg. A little side story before I begin. I gave one of my first exhibits when the Florida International Museum was here. Who remembers that from 20 years ago?
Yeah.
That's my first visit to Florida. My grandparents were living in Newport Richie at the time, retired. They came down for the opening of the exhibit. It was the Cold War when it got hot, I believe, and they had a Cuban Missile Crisis display. We ended up at the Cold War Museum buying the Cuban Missile Crisis display, complete with the SA-2 missile that was there. That's now part of our collection and our holdings up in Virginia. So a little connection to Florida. This is one of the first places I started talking and venuing and doing exhibits. So I'm glad to be back. Now, for tonight's program, we've talked about the Cold War. The last so many years, 30 years, the Cold War is gone. It's repeating itself. Ukraine is another proxy war. The Soviets, quote-unquote, Russia, is backing one side, we're backing another. The last 8 years, there's been a civil war there. How many people knew there's been a civil war in Ukraine the last 8 years? Very few people. This war today did not just pop out of the blue. It's been festering for 8 years. So go do some research, look online, find out what's been going on, and you can read between the lines as to why this war is happening now. We're going to back one side, they're going to back another. The Cold War 2.0 has begun. But that's not today's talk. Today's talk is one specific incident of the Cold War, the U-2 incident. I'll be talking about the U-2 incident, my father, the misinformation, the truth of what took place. I'll also mention the Steven Spielberg movie, Bridge of Spies, and at the end, I'll answer any questions that you may have. So to start, I want to talk about this movie, Bridge of Spies. Who here has seen that movie? Okay, less than half, and that's usually what happens. Who has not seen it, just for a visual? Yes, more of you have not seen it than have seen it. So I would propose next year about this time we do a movie night. Watch the movie, I'll do some commentary, and do some Q&A at the end. I'll ask the director about that in a bit. This movie came out in 2015. I found out about it in 2014 through the trade magazines, Hollywood Reporter, things like that. At first, there was rumors that Spielberg is going to do this movie. And I'm thinking, he's not going to do this movie. He has no reason to do this movie. And all of a sudden, I get confirmation through the press that he's going to do this movie that will portray my dad. My first thoughts, how do you get in touch with Steven Spielberg? You just can't reach out. He has an unlisted number. Everybody wants a piece of him. So I'm thinking, how can I get in touch with him? I call some friends in Hollywood. I grew up in Los Angeles. Some of my friends or their parents were actors. Thought I'd get an introduction. Could not get an introduction through family friends. I resort to Google. I type in his name. I type in his movies. I find people he worked with. I type in their names. up pop some of their email addresses. So I'm able to send out an unsolicited email to Mr. Spielberg through some of his contemporaries. And I basically say the following. Hello, my name is Gary Powers Jr. I'd like to talk to Mr. Spielberg about this movie that will portray my dad. It's very important that we express the Powers family's concerns. If he bases the movie off the misinformation of the time, they'll be painting him in a negative light. If they base it off the declassified information that's come to surface the last 50 plus years, they'll be painting him as a hero to our country. So for obvious reasons, I wanted to reach out, try to establish contact. As a result of that email, I get a phone call from the producer, Mark Platt. Mark Platt's better known for his production of Wicked on Broadway. So very well regarded, very well respected within the industry. Mark and I talked for an hour in July of 2014. At the end of the conversation, hey, Mr. Powers, thank you so much for reaching out to us. You're very knowledgeable on the Cold War, the U2 incident, what your father went through. How would you like to consult for the film? That would be really nice. Thank you for making it. So I get this contract, I'm reading through it, I'm to answer questions, I'm to be on set as required, as requested. I'm to provide photographs of the family from the 50s that they can Photoshop, put their actors' heads on. I'm to provide audio tapes that my father recorded so they can listen to him in his own voice as to what he had gone through. The very end of this contract, the last paragraph, it says, they don't have to listen to me. Very last sentence. If I don't like the end result, I can't sue. No recourse. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, they're going to use the family's name, they're going to tie my hands, and then they're going to do whatever they want to do. So I'm thinking, what am I going to do? And so I took a couple days to think it over, and I ended up signing the contract. I thought it was more important to be a part of the production, try to steer them in the right direction. If I had walked away, I'd have had no say whatsoever. So I am very glad that I signed them a dotted line. I like the movie. The Powers family in general likes the movie. The big picture is historically accurate. It accurately portrays the time period of the Cold War, duck and cover drills, some of you probably did as kids. It accurately portrays the tensions between our countries, the fear of a nuclear war, very accurately portrayed in the movie. That's the big picture. You've got to remember, this is Hollywood. They use dramatic effect, they take artistic liberties, they will embellish. Spielberg has to take 8 years of time and smush it into 2 hours and 15 minutes. So you're seeing this historical event through his eyes. So it's not 100% accurate. The details of each scene are not accurate. Only the people on the bridge know what was said. Spielberg had to create this with his actors, with his scriptwriters, to bring this historic event to life. So again, the big picture's accurate, but the details of each scene are not 100% correct. In fact, there is some misinformation, fake news of the time, that was in the movie, because it's that time period, and that's what people were reading. So it was incorporated in the film. The film is based off of two books. One, Strangers on a Bridge, was written by James Donovan, who Tom Hanks portrays. He's the attorney that represents the Soviet spy Abel after his capture, then brokers the exchange between the Soviet spy and my father in 1962. The other book, my dad's autobiography, Operation Overflight. He writes that in 1970 with the information he has available at the time, middle of the Cold War. He could not put everything in it he wanted to, but he did get it out for public consumption. So when I am growing up in Southern California, I'm aware that my father was shot down, imprisoned, and exchanged. I thought it was normal. I thought everybody's dad went through something like that. That perception changed August 1st, 1977. Dad dies in a helicopter crash while working for NBC Television out of Los Angeles. I'm 12 years old at the time. I come home to a house full of people, when for my mom and I, the bad news, lives are turned upside down, I become very introverted. I don't know why the press is calling the house to ask questions, why friends at school would come up to me and tell me something they knew about my dad. All of a sudden, these peers at school would know something about me and my family, but I wouldn't know anything about them or their family. So this was a little bit of an adjustment that I was going through after the loss of my father. Strangers occasionally would come up to me. Oh, Gary Power's kid. Why did he do this? Why didn't he do that? Well, at the time, as a kid, I didn't know the answers, so I didn't want to talk about it. So high school was challenging. Mom had her hands full. I didn't have a father figure. Growing up in LA, running the streets at night, Sunset Boulevard until 2 or 3 in the morning, and then home to go to school the next day, I got through high school, thank goodness, and then into college. Well, after 4 years in college, I failed out. I was president of the fraternity. I had a lot of fun. Learned more in the fraternity than I did in college on how to deal with people, how to negotiate, how to put out fires, how to organize events and activities. So it was a blessing in disguise that I failed out. I worked full time, tried to get a promotion in the job where I was at, could not get the promotion without a degree. I went back. I got my philosophy degree in 1991, moved to Mammoth Lakes, California. My grandmother dies in 91, 92. I go out to Virginia to find out, to go to the funeral. When I get to Virginia, I'm looking around at these people that I don't know that are family. So I end up moving to Virginia in 1992. I do a graduate degree at George Mason University in nonprofit management, public administration. And all the while, I'm now starting to do research in college. I'm trying to find out a little bit more about my dad. Doing this research while I'm going through my school. At first, I'm able to find 85 of his letters that he wrote to and from his family and the journal that he kept while incarcerated. So while I'm in graduate school, I can't sleep, I'm a little ADD, I bounce off walls, so I start typing in and transcribing his handwritten letters. Then in 2017, I was able to have self-published his letters to and from prison. Title, Letters from a Soviet Prison. The personal journal and correspondence of CIA-82 pilot Francis Gary Powers. His thoughts, his feelings, his hopes and despairs while incarcerated. I thought it was going to be good for the public record. Primary source document. How can you argue with this guy talking, writing down his thoughts and feelings in prison? He's not lying to himself when he talks about how he was shot out of the sky and captured. So I thought that would be very important for the historical record, scholars, historians, students in the future. So as growing up, what I found out is that Dad was born, while in college, and I'm starting to do this research, I find out that Dad is on the cover of Time magazine. Here I am, 19, 20 years old, in college, finding out for the first time that Dad's on the cover of Time magazine. What else was he on the cover of? What other books were written about him? Curiosity. So I start to do this research. 35 years later, I've got 3 books out. I'm lecturing internationally. Now, Dad was born August 17th, 1929, Southwest Virginia. I talked to a few people earlier from Norton and from Bristol. Virginia is right near, the town Virginia is about an hour north of Tennessee and about 5 minutes from Kentucky. It's as far southwest as you can go without being in Kentucky. Appalachia, coal fields. My grandfather, Dad's dad, is a coal miner. He also owns a shoe shop, the Norton City Shoe Shop in Virginia. He fixes the miners' shoes on weekends after they come out of the mines. So this is when my father's growing up, the height of the Depression, 1929 to 1940. Dad tells me at one point in time as a kid that he was laying awake in his bedroom, listening to his parents talk in the kitchen. They were not talking about where the next dollar would come from. They were talking about where the next nickel would come from. The height of the Depression. Your parents, grandparents lived through it. They know what it was like. The Great Recession of 2008 pales in comparison. Kids today have no concept of what that type of depression is like. So Dad, when he's about 11 years old, 1940, 41, gets the opportunity to ride in a plane with a female pilot at a country fair. He takes a 15-minute ride, he lands, runs up to one of the sisters. I left my heart up there. He knows he wants to be a pilot. So he is now one of six children. He's the second oldest. He's the first of his family to go to college. Goes to Milligan College in Tennessee. 1950, he graduates and immediately enlists in the U.S. Air Force. He wants to be a pilot. He's pursuing his dream, his passion. He wants to do this. He's following his dream to be an Air Force fighter pilot. So in 1950, he enlists. In 1952, he gets his wings. He's an F-84 pilot, flying F-84s out of Turner Air Force Base near Albany, Georgia. There, between 1952 and 1956, he's training to fly planes. He's getting ready to go over to the Korean Peninsula. Sometime in early 1956, he's supposed to deploy. He ends up with an appendicitis that lays him up in the hospital. He misses his deployment. A couple months go by, he recovers. A couple more months go by, he finds his name on a duty roster to report to the commanding officer. There's some guys out of Washington, D.C. who are looking for certain pilots for employment opportunities. My dad is a little confused. Opportunities? What opportunities are there? I'm an Air Force fighter pilot. I've been in for 6 years. I have 14 more years to go before I retire. What possible opportunities are there? Curiosity gets the best of him. He goes over to the commanding officer's meeting. Two guys in suits from the CIA are there. They're looking to recruit the best pilots out of the Air Force to fly reconnaissance missions. During the meeting, they don't talk about the plane, they don't talk about the missions. All they say is it's very dangerous, it's very patriotic, you'll be stationed overseas. Oh, and by the way, your pay will be doubled or tripled the Air Force salary. Just enough incentive to get the best pilots to sign on the dotted line. So my father goes home. He talks this opportunity over with his first wife. They agree that this is something that will help advance his career. He goes back to the next meeting. He signs the non-disclosure agreement. That's when the CIA folks tell him, you'll be flying the U-2 spy plane, 70,000 feet and above, over foreign hostile countries, taking photographs, finding out the strengths and weaknesses of our adversaries. So my father is trained to fly the U-2 at Area 51 in the Nevada desert. 2 months of training, he's shipped over to Incirlik Air Force Base near Adana, Turkey. This is his U-2 squadron based in Adana. My father is on the back row standing up on the far left. So Dad is flying U-2s over various countries between 1956 and 1960. During that time period, he flies 27 successful missions, some over the Soviet Union, other missions over other countries, China, Tibet, India, Pakistan, Middle Eastern countries, probably some allies too. Allies today may not be allies tomorrow. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Turkey. So it's good to know what our strengths, their strengths and weaknesses are, should something like that need to be known. So Dad, after training, is flying these missions, 27 successful missions. The 28th one is on May 1st of 60. It's supposed to take off from Peshawar, Pakistan, fly 3,000 miles north to Bodø, Norway. Should take about 9 hours to fly. Dad gets up very early in the morning on May 1st, gets into his flight suit, goes through his briefing, finds out what targets to overfly. He puts on his suit, hermetically sealed. He starts to breathe pure oxygen for about an hour. The reason that pilots who fly at 70,000 feet and above will breathe pure oxygen ahead of a mission is to get the nitrogen bubbles out of the bloodstream. Pilots who fly at that altitude can get something similar to the bends. So this way they can alleviate that problem, they don't die while they're flying. So after he's all briefed and breathed, he takes off at 9 a.m., crosses over the Soviet's border at about 68,000 feet, flips on and off the camera switches that will take the photographic imagery of the ground below. He's now at an altitude of 70,500 feet after 4 hours of flying. He's over the city of Sverdlovsk, and there's a bright orange flash. Lights up the exterior of the canopy. Shockwave hits the plane, pushes the plane forward, throws Dad back in his seat. Dad realizes that something's gone wrong. The controls no longer respond. You can't fly a plane without a tail section. The near miss of a Soviet SA-2 missile has exploded near enough of the tail section to cause structural failure. But prior to these missions, or prior to this year, the Soviets had the SA-1 missile that could only reach 60,000 feet. Over 4 years of research and development, the Soviets improved their weapon system. The SA-2s come online. May 1st, 1960, they fire 8 missiles at Dad's plane. One of them explodes behind the tail section, causing it to fall out of the sky. So once the explosion happens, the tail section is damaged and or blown off. The nose pitches forward, the wings snap off. Dad goes into an inverted spin, tumbling out of the sky. He is basically upside down in the cockpit, being held in by his harness, by his seatbelt. He's being banged around. He's about to hit the destruct button. But he realizes, I only have 60 seconds to get out of this airplane once that button's hit. I've got to make sure I can eject. Well, if he ejects in the position he's in, he will sever his legs off. Dad does the following. He starts to panic. He forces himself to relax, to take a deep breath, to think things through. How can I get out of this plane? Oh, I can crawl out. Immediately, it opens up the canopy, it floats off into space, undoes his harness, is immediately sucked up halfway out of the cockpit, still connected by his air hose. 2 or 3 feet of air hose. Half in the cockpit, half out of the cockpit, being banged around. He can no longer reach the destruct button. He can no longer see it. His faceplate has frosted over. He can't see past his nose. He knows he's getting closer and closer to the ground. He's able to break free of the air hose, falls free of the airplane, parachute opens automatically at 15,000 feet, parachutes down to the ground. On the way down, he notices a dark car following his descent. He lands on the outskirts of a collective farm. The farmers are working the fields. The kids, it's a holiday, they're home, they're working the fields with their parents. They see the commotion. This particular group of farmers sees Dad coming down. They rush up to him, help him with his backpack, his parachute, his helmet. They start to ask him questions in Russian. They think he's one of theirs. Well, Dad does not speak Russian. He shrugs his shoulders, makes one of the farmers a little nervous. Who is this guy? Falls out of the sky, doesn't speak our language. About that time, the black car shows up. Two men get out, put him in the back seat. They take him to a holding place in the center part of town. There, for the next few hours, he's asked some basic questions by someone who speaks broken English. Who are you? What are you doing here? Where'd you come from? To which Dad would reply, my name is Gary Powers. I am lost. I have a mechanical malfunction. Can you take me to the American Embassy? No, that is not permitted. Can you take me to the American Red Cross? No, that is not permitted. And this is how it went the first few hours of his capture. Later that afternoon, evening, KGB guards show up, take Dad by airplane, armed guards to move to Moscow's airport, then shuttle him over by car to Lubyanka prison. Lubyanka is the infamous KGB prison, part of and adjacent to the KGB headquarters, downtown Moscow. So that's where Dad finds himself, first out of captivity, May 1st of 1960. Now I'm going to backtrack for 1 second. I just talked to you about the shoot down sequence. And what I told you is what Dad told me, it's what I've read in his books and audio tapes and all that. I want to compare that to what Spielberg does in the movie. In Spielberg's movie, the U-2 is flying along at 70,000 feet. The pilot sees two missiles in the distance, foreshadowing. Dad did not see any other missiles. He only felt the one that impacted the rear of the tail section. In the movie, the third missile explodes behind the tail section. It pushes the plane over. The engine conks out. It's starting to zoom down. the dials are unwinding, the alarm bells are going off, the canopy's starting to crack. Pilot's about to hit the destruct button. The canopy shatters, sucks him out of the plane. He's still connected by his air hose. But in the movie, it is 15 feet of air hose. He's swinging around the plane. He's crawling hand over hand to get back in the cockpit. So you can see, fact and fiction. Spielberg takes this dramatic effect, this dramatic scene, and makes it even that more dramatic for the film. He wants to keep you, the audience, on the edge of your seats to keep you coming back to see more movies. Hollywood does this very well. So, fact and fiction, a little bit of how they portrayed it in the film versus what actually happened. So, Dad is now in Lubyanka prison, May 1st. For the next 5 days, the Soviets say nothing about the shootdown. At home in Washington, D.C., Eisenhower is meeting with Alan Dulles, head of the CIA. They're meeting with Air Force and State Department officials. They're trying to figure out, where's the plane? Where's the pilot? Why didn't he land in Bodø, Norway, where he should have landed? But so far, no information is coming out of the Soviet Union. On May 5th, Khrushchev releases this photograph of the quote-unquote U-2 wreckage. He holds a press conference, gleefully announced to the world, "Ah, comrades, we've shot down an American spy plane. But he makes no reference as to the pilot's fate. So, Kelly Johnson, the designer of the airplane, comes in, looks at this photograph of CIA analysts, and says, "That's not my plane. The rivets are wrong, the wing shape is wrong, that's not the U-2. So the CIA is a little confused. That must mean they don't have the plane. It must mean the pilot's dead, or else Khrushchev would have paraded him around as evidence. We can authorize the release of the cover story." So Eisenhower authorizes the cover story to be released, saying, "An unarmed weather research plane." Where have I heard that recently? The Chinese are using the same cover story that the U-2s used 60 years ago. Oh, history is repeating itself. An unarmed weather research plane may have accidentally strayed across the border after the pilot had radioed trouble with his oxygen equipment. Once the cover story was in place, 2 days go by. Khrushchev comes back up to center stage, another press conference, very gleefully. "Ah, comrades, not only did we shoot down the plane, we have also captured the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, who's quite alive and kicking, and was confessed a spy for the CIA." Now, I have to take you all back 63 years. In 1960, very few people were aware of the CIA. Top secret, government agency, created in 1947 as part of the National Security Act to safeguard Americans at home by gathering intelligence from abroad. So it was a very big embarrassment for Eisenhower, who was a very well-respected president, World War II hero, Supreme Allied Commander, he's the reason we're not speaking German right now in America, he was just the man at the time. But now he's been caught with his hand in the cookie jar. He's been caught lying to the world public. The very first time a U.S. president has been caught lying was as a result of the U-2 incident. Now, after 63 years, we take it for granted. So, Eisenhower is trying to salvage his presidency. He's thinking of blaming Alan Dulles. Let Alan Dulles be the scapegoat, the fall guy. Let him be blamed for this rogue mission that was not successful. But Eisenhower realizes, if he does that and blames a subordinate, public opinion will think that he, as president, is not in control of his own country. So he steps up to the plate, he holds a press conference, he takes full responsibility for his actions. During his press conference, Eisenhower calls his actions, quote, "a vital but distasteful necessity in order to avert another Pearl Harbor." And while all this is unfolding, Dad's been stuck in a Russian prison cell, going through the interrogations. 16-hour days, bright spotlight, grueling questions, threats of death. No physical torture, but a lot of mental anguish. Dad told me a story about how they would interrogate him, take him back to his cell, he'd lie down on the cot, 2-3 minutes would go by, they'd put them back up, take them back in, start the process over again. I talked to a KGB officer who was in charge of writing the interrogation questions for my father. He told me that the reason Dad was not tortured is that he was too high profile an individual. The world knew that they had captured Francis Gary Powers. The Soviets wanted to put their best foot forward. They wanted to use this for extreme propaganda purposes, make them look good, embarrass the United States. So, as opposed to being tortured, he was solitary confinement, sleep deprivation, long hours, trying to break them by any means necessary, short of physical abuse. The same KGB officer mentioned to me that the interrogators respected my father for how he conducted himself while interrogated. Wow. Oh my gosh, a compliment from the KGB? That really, really shook me when I heard that. But it made sense. He was professional. He was you know, not doing anything that he shouldn't be doing. He was acting according to how he should be acting. So once this is blown, the newspapers start to print these articles about the American spy plane being shot down, the summit conference is in jeopardy. This is all while Dad's going through the interrogations. The first 7 days, Dad is lying to his captors outright, holding back as much information as he can, misleading them any way he can. But on May 7th, May 10th, international headlines around the world start to appear. Summit conference in jeopardy, U2 shot down, Eisenhower caught lying. The type of articles that were being printed in the newspapers. The KGB guard in charge of the interrogations comes rushing in on or about May 10th, copy of the New York Times, shoves the newspaper in Dad's face, yells out, "You've lied to us. You told us you were trained in Arizona. Well, the New York Times says you were trained in Nevada at Area 51. You might as well tell us everything. We'll get it out of your American press anyways." So, Dad is stuck between a rock and a hard place. If he tells the full truth, he's giving away secrets. If he lies to him, he can get shot, face the death penalty for espionage. So for the next 3 months of solitary confinement, interrogations, he does the following. He tells the full truth when he knows they can verify the information in the press. That will give him credibility. He lies to him when he knows they cannot find out the answers. Names of pilots, number of missions, specifications about the equipment on board. Then he gives a part truth, part lie, dances around the question, when he knows that they know something about the question they're asking, but not enough to contradict his answer, such as the altitude he was flying. Dad always maintained that he was at the maximum altitude of 68,000 feet when he was shot down. And he did this for two reasons. First, close enough to be believable, yet far enough away to keep other planes, other pilots, out of harm's way. U-2s are flying between 70 and 75,000 feet on operational missions. Dad wants to convince the Soviets to explode their warhead at 68,000 feet, the maximum altitude, so that there's a 2,000 to 7,000 foot buffer between where the missiles explode and where the planes are flying. The other reason, he wanted to get a message back to the CIA. "Hey guys, I'm not telling the full truth." And this was eventually discovered when he was brought back home and debriefed. Here's a photo of Khrushchev on or about May 7th, May 10th, holding up some gold coins, evidence of Dad's espionage activities. The U-2 pilots were given gold coins, gold watches, gold rings, currencies, in case they could barter or bribe their way to a border. Dad, 1,300 miles within the Soviet Union, was not near a border. There was nowhere to go. The Soviets released this photo of my father in captivity to show that he's alive and well. They put him back in his helmet and his flight suit. The expression on Dad's face, he is not happy in this way. He knows it's going to be used for propaganda reasons. Another photo of him in captivity, overalls, showing that he's alive and well and not being mistreated. Khrushchev is upset. Eisenhower is offering an olive branch with one hand, but yet a dagger with the other, quote unquote, sending these spy missions over the Soviet Union. Eisenhower, Khrushchev was in America in 1959, the guest of our country. Eisenhower was supposed to go to the Soviet Union in the fall of 60. That trip was canceled because of the U-2 incident. The May 16th summit conference happens. May 16th, de Gaulle, the British Prime Minister, Khrushchev, Eisenhower meet in Paris, France. They're looking to try to thaw the Cold War. Khrushchev is demanding an Eisenhower apology and a stop to the U-2 flights. Eisenhower refuses to apologize. As a result, Khrushchev stands up, berates the president, storms out. The summit conference falls apart. It looks like the Cold War is heating up. And all this time, Dad's been stuck in the Russian prison cell going through the interrogations. He's in there for 3 months of solitary confinement and interrogations until the three-day show trial, August 17th to August 20th, 1960. Dad is in the docket on the right, standing up, defense counsel in front of him, the three judges, the prosecutor on the left side of the stage, international audience of VIPs, dignitaries, and press. After 3 days of a trial, Dad is waiting to hear his sentence. The defense counsel, the guy in the glasses on the left side of the screen, not once during the trial objected to any question asked of my father. In the Soviet Union, you are guilty until proven innocent. So, very unique switching of words there to make all the difference in the court setting. I believe that the prosecutor, the defense, the judges, the state were all in agreement that they would give Dad 10 years imprisonment, no death penalty, to show how nice and humble and good a country we were. So, I love this headline, not doctored, actual front page headline, August 20th and 60th. On one side, the right side, Powers gets a 10-year sentence. On the left side, space capsule is caught in midair by U.S. plane on re-entry from orbit. The United States is bragging, boasting. We are ahead of the Soviets. We are winning the space race. We have this technology. They don't. What they're not saying in the article is that the payload that was captured from outer space was a film canister from the first successful spy satellite mission. Interesting. Dad's being sentenced for spying. Here we are still spying, but now with satellites. This is the Corona spy satellite, the first successful mission. Dad spends a total of 21 months in captivity, almost 2 years. 3 months solitary confinement, going through the interrogations, three-day trial, 18 more months at Vladimir Prison in the central part of the former Soviet Union. In Vladimir, Dad has a cellmate, Zergard Krimish, a Latvian. The Latvian tells my dad that he was caught smuggling goods and people in and out of Latvia while working for the British. Dad and this guy get along. They help each other endure the hardship. They write letters home. They read some magazines and books that are sent to them. They cannot get any Western press. No Washington Post, no New York Times, no Time or Newsweek. They are able to get copies of Pravda. They can get, what is it called? Give me a second, out of the UK, the social paper, the Daily Worker. So they get the Daily Worker out of the UK. They get copies of Pravda that can be translated by the cellmate. So they're getting information around the world, world events, but it's always from a Soviet or a socialist perspective, not a Western press. So Dad goes through 21 months of captivity with Zergard. Now, Zergard is a brilliant guy. He speaks 5 or 6 languages fluently. He's a grand master at chess. He teaches Dad to play chess in the Russian prison, pass the time. A couple weeks go by, Dad can play a game. He knows how to set up the chess board. He's holding his own, kind of. This guy's really smart. Then one day, when Dad can play this game, Zergard does the following. He sets up the chessboard, he turns around, he blindfolds himself. He still beats Dad at chess. Brilliant guy. But my dad's thinking, wow, this guy's really smart. I bet he can remember everything I say. He could be a plant. And we do think he was, circumstantial evidence, no hard proof, but it makes sense. He probably copped the deal to get a lenient sentence or an early release or special privileges to squeal, to stool on fellow prisoners. So after 21 months of captivity, February 10th, 1962, my father is exchanged for Soviet spy Colonel Rudolf Abel, the Glenicker Bridge, Potsdam, Germany. It is a cold, dark, foggy morning, right out of the John Le Carré novel. We've got this Glenicker Bridge picture with a very famous image of the sign, "You are leaving the American sector," in four different languages. On the other side of that bridge is communism, East Germany or East Berlin. I love this political cartoon of the era. Abel on the left side, surrounded by his CIA and FBI entourage. Dad on the right side, surrounded by his KGB entourage. They're about to be exchanged. The tagline that you can't see at the bottom of this says, "Peace through trade." Another photo of the bridge, taken from west looking east. Google says this is the spy exchange. It is not. This photo was taken in the afternoon, once the news broke. Curiosity seekers, ooh, let's go look at the bridge where these spies were exchanged. So they went down, and that's when this photo was taken. So, just as an emphasis, not everything online is true. Google says, I'm sorry to disappoint you. Google says this is the exchange. So when I talk to students, I always tell them, verify your sources, double check, don't believe everything you read online, fact check it before you start printing it in your papers. Another little thing here, a little treat, where is this? This is a behind the scenes look of Spielberg getting ready to shoot the exchange scene on the bridge. Oh,
where to go?
Hold on a second. Okay. I'm not sure why that doesn't want to do this. Okay, hold on a second. I'm going to close this down and do it from the screen. That's the wrong one. Sorry for the confusion there. Sometimes I get a little. Okay. There. It's an unrealized road. Okay, there we go.
For me, it was super powerful to be standing on the bridge, the Glenicker Bridge. It says the Bridge of Spies as you walk up onto that bridge. It was freezing cold.
Cold. The bridge was freezing. It was, but we were all in it together. And that was our last bit in Berlin, and what a way to go out.
I couldn't do the dialogue, I don't know, we'll do the whole dialogue on a side dialogue.
We all reacted to it. I don't think there was a single actor there or member of the crew that weren't taking into account the fact that this is where incredible history happened. And it had global international repercussions. And to be there recreating it raises the stakes of what we're doing.
We're pushing on a nice media shot of Abel's reactions in the environment. And then we're going to go back to Abel and then turn into this configuration.
Have you arranged all this for me? Well, let's see what this is before I take credit for it.
Okay, so when Dad gets home, whoops, I'm going the wrong way. There we go. So that the Soviet spy Abel are exchanged. Abel goes home, a hero of the Soviet Union, parade in his honor, postage stamp in his likeness, some medals for his heroics. Dad comes home to controversy. While he's in prison, there have been articles being written, editorials being written, saying that he defected. Landed the plane intact, spilled his guts, told the Soviets everything he knew, or hadn't followed orders and committed suicide. All of which were part truths, mistruths, some innuendos of the time. Now it is true that the CIA gave the pilots the option of taking a suicide pin with them on these missions. It was hidden in a silver dollar. This particular one opens up, concealment space. The ones the pilots had a hole drilled in it, The needle was put in, poison around it, wear it around your neck as a good luck charm. It was told to the pilots that if you're caught, you will be tortured. Here is a way to alleviate the pain and suffering. Optional device to take, optional device to use, at your discretion in the event of torture, not in the event of capture. So Dad follows his orders. He does what he does. On the third strip search, the Soviets' KGB find the device. Not the dollar, but Dad has thrown the dollar away while he was parachuting down and kept the pin in the flight suit pocket. On the third strip search, they find the pin. Dad goes, oh, be very careful with that. He does not want to have a murder conviction on top of an espionage conviction. He is in enough trouble as it is. The Soviets test it on a dog. The dog dies in 20 seconds of the investigation. The poison shuts down the central nervous system. The dog dies from lack of oxygen. Now, right hand, left hand of the government. The CIA assures Eisenhower that no pilot will live through a shootdown. They don't tell the pilots that. The cover story that Eisenhower releases says, pilot radioed trouble with oxygen equipment. Had the pilot used a needle, he would have died from lack of oxygen, plausible deniability. Nobody tells the pilots what the cover story is. They give them the equipment to escape, if possible. It's an optional device to take, an optional device to use. So left hand of the government, right hand of the government. When Khrushchev comes up at one of his press conferences, oh, look at these evil Americans. This is what they give their spy pilots to commit suicide with. This one wanted to live to see another day. And from that moment on, in the press and certain circles, Dad had disobeyed orders. But again, there were no orders to begin with. Optional take, optional use, at their discretion in the event of torture. So, Dad comes home to this controversy. He's debriefed at a safe house in Maryland for 3 weeks. Debriefings are sometimes like an interrogation, trying to make sure, did you defect? What did you tell them? Why are you collaborating with them? What happened? How were you shot down? And he would go over and over again what he went through. After 3 weeks, the CIA clears him. They realize he did everything he was supposed to do. He followed his orders to the T. He's able to see his parents for the first time in about 2 years. Ida Powers on the left, Oliver Powers, his dad, on the right. After 3 weeks of debriefing, Dad appears before a select committee hearing. The senators included on this session, Prescott Bush, President Bush's grandfather, Barry Goldwater out of Arizona, Al Gore Sr. Those type of senators were on this committee reviewing the U2 case. 2 or 3 hours of questions back and forth, answers back and forth. At the end of the session, my dad gets a standing ovation from the U.S. Senate. A pat on his back. Good job for your country. So the U.S. Senate has cleared him. The CIA has cleared him. But the court of public opinion has not yet cleared him because of the fake news. He defected, he landed a plane, he didn't follow orders. Dad, for his part, didn't care what other people thought he should or should not have done. He knew that what he did was the right thing to do under the circumstance he found himself in. So he was often quoted as saying, he'd do the exact same things again, given the exact same set of circumstances. So Dad is now working at the CIA headquarters for about one more year, getting adjusted to life in America, freedom, being able to, you know, not be in a 12-foot by 9-foot cell. He's a little stir crazy. He wants to fly again. He's a pilot. He's been in jail for 2 years, a desk job for about a year. Per his contract, he's supposed to be able to go back into the military at a rank comparable to his peers, no loss of duty time. But I believe, no evidence I found, but I believe is that the Air Force did not want to take him back in. He was the known spy. If they employ him, the Air Force will be accused of employing spies. So they're trying to figure out what to do with him. Air Force doesn't really want him. They're obligated to take him back. CIA doesn't want him. His cover's blown. Lockheed Aircraft Corporation, Kelly Johnson, the designer of the U-2. Hey, Frank, you'll always have a job with me if you can pass the mental and physical examinations. Dad passes with flying colors, no ill effects. He signs on with Lockheed. He's a test pilot with Lockheed between 1963 and 1970. At that time, Dad is happy. He's got a pilot job. Kelly Johnson, the Skunkworks program, is happy. They've got a test pilot. The Air Force is happy. They don't have Dad. Everything's working out. And then Dad writes his book. This is a photo of him in 1963 when he signed on with Lockheed there in Burbank, California. This is a photo of the family in 1970 when his book was, published. I'm a little five-year-old kid, my dad, my mom, and my sister in the background. So between 1963 and 1970, he's flying for Lockheed. In 1970, he writes his story, Operation Overflight. The same month that the book is put before the CIA review board for review, as per his contract, so it can be vetted, make sure there's no classified information in it, he's let go from Lockheed. Coincidence? My dad didn't think so. He thought that because he wrote his book, he ruffled somebody's feathers, the government contractor, beholden to the government for contracts, obligated or asked to let him go. Now, there's no official proof I found to confirm that. But what I did find through FOIA requests 2017 when I'm writing my book is that Dad gets a little upset once he's fired. He hires an attorney. The attorney writes letters back and forth to the CIA and the Air Force. They negotiate a financial compensation package in lieu of an Air Force retirement. So all of a sudden Dad has a little financial stability. He's on the lecture circuit for the next 2 years between 70 and 72, promoting his book, talking about his experiences. In 1972, he gets a job with KGIL radio station in the San Fernando Valley, reporting on news, weather, and traffic, flying a fixed-wing Cessna over the LA Basin. The bracelet on his right arm, POW-MIA. He was very active in that community in the 70s for the Vietnam veterans. One of his fellow U-2 pilots, Harvey Stockman, Harvey Stockman, U-2 pilot with Dad, went back into the Air Force, gets shot down over Vietnam a couple of years in Hanoi Hilton. So he's wearing that POW-MI bracelet to support his fellow pilot, one of his friends. In 1976, Dad gets a job with NBC Television, flying their helicopter, reporting on news, weather, and traffic, but this time for the evening news. About a year and a half into those assignments, August 1st, 1977, Dad's coming back from Santa Barbara, California. Helicopter runs out of gas and crashes. He and the cameraman are killed in the crash. So, very sad way to end, but he did die another hero. He's starting to auto-rotate. He sees kids playing baseball where he's about to land. He diverts. He does not want to land on top of the kids playing baseball. So he went out to make sure that he didn't kill anybody on the ground. Now, he's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Presidential authorization by Jimmy Carter at the time. My mother joined him there in 2004. Now, what I have not said, and this is we're wrapping up here, is how the U.S. government eventually was able to provide, award my father the POW Medal and the Silver Star. In 1998, as I'm doing all this research, there is a declassification conference on the U-2 program held at Fort McNair. CIA, Air Force host this joint conference. It's declassified. Dad's altitude, 70,500 feet. The near miss of the missile. There was no flame out, there was no descent, there was no sabotage, it was not the pilot's fault. It was the near miss of the missile that brought down the plane. Finally declassified, 1998. It also was declassified. CIA, working hand in hand with US Air Force, could not be separated. For all intent and purposes, it was a military operation. At the time, in the 50s, it could not be. A military plane, a military pilot, over a foreign hostile country is an act of war. Therefore, that's why Eisenhower wanted the CIA, a civilian agency, to run the operation. If it was civilian, it would be espionage. It would not be an act of war. So, once that word military was declassified, I was able to send a letter to the Air Force Review Board. Dear members of the review board, here's some newly declassified information showing that it was a military operation. Does this qualify my father for a POW medal? And I get a nice letter back. Mr. Powers, thanks for writing to us. This is what we are here to do. When new information becomes available, we can update the public record. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. Your dad will have 14 years of military service, the rank of captain, and will be working with the family to award him posthumously the POW medal sometime in the 2000s. So on May 1st, 2000, 40th anniversary, dad is posthumously awarded by the US Air Force the POW medal. Then 12 years go by. June 2012, the US Air Force steps up to the plate again. This is General Schwartz, head of the Air Force at the time, presenting the Silver Star to the family. My son, Gary Powers III, 10 years old at the time, is receiving it on behalf of the family in June of 2012. So as a family, we are very honored, very humbled, very grateful to our nation for helping them to set the record straight. It took 40 and 50 years respectively, but it goes to show it's never too late to set the record straight. And we're very glad that they were able to do that. So that is basically the overview of the U2 incident, my father's involvement, what he had gone through, the accolades he's received posthumously. The last thing I want to say is in regards to the Cold War Museum that was referenced earlier. While I'm doing my research to find out about my father, I realize that there are hundreds, thousands of men, women, fought, sacrificed, some of whom died during this conflict, the Cold War, that were not being recognized for their service to our country. So I thought it would be very good to honor our Cold War veterans. I also was about starting to give lectures in 92-ish, 93-ish in Northern Virginia. I go into a classroom to give a talk on the U2 incident. I get blank stares from the kids. They thought I was there to talk about the U2 rock band. I knew something had to be done to preserve Cold War history. Honor veterans, preserve history, educate kids so it doesn't happen again. It's happening again. So in 1996, I found the museum. Thought it would take 3 years. Fundraised $3 million. Shouldn't be too hard to do. Took 15 years to get brick and mortar. And in that time period, we started to collect Cold War artifacts. Very easy to find in the 90s and early 2000s. Very hard to find today. So we were ahead of the curve when we started this museum. It's open on the weekends, staffed by volunteers, 45 miles west of Washington, D.C. Items from the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the USS Liberty incident, the USS Pueblo incident, overhead reconnaissance platforms, civil defense, you name Cold War stuff, we've got a piece of something from something. More information online, coldwar.org. And if you want to reach me, garypowers.com. If you like what you heard today, I'd appreciate it if you could steer me in direction of other venues. I'm always looking for lecture venues. I travel the country, writing, teaching, and lecturing. It's been an honor and a privilege to be here today. Thank you to Rui. Thank you to my friends, Jack and Carol, and his guests. And thank you for spending the last hour with me.
You've heard a presentation by Francis Gary Powers Jr. recorded last Thursday evening at the St. Petersburg Museum of History for their Happy Hour with a Historian series.